Chapter 6 Conclusion. Foma's triumph was complete and beyond attack. Certainly, without him, nothing would have been settled, and the accomplished fact stifled all doubts and objections. The gratitude of those he had made happy was beyond all bounds. My uncle and Nastya waved me off when I attempted to drop a hint at the process by which Foma's consent to their marriage had been obtained. Sashenka cried, "Good, kind Foma Fomitch, I would embroider him a cushion in woolwork," and even reproached me for my hard-heartedness. I believe that Batsheyev, in the fervour of his conversion, would have strangled me if I had ventured to say anything disrespectful about Foma Fomitch. He followed Foma about like a little dog, gazed at him with devout reverence, and at every word the latter uttered he would exclaim, "You are a noble man, Foma. You are a learned man, Foma." As for Yezhevikin, he was highly delighted. The old man had, for a long time past, seen that Nastenka had turned Yegor Ilyich's head, and from that time forward his one dream, waking and sleeping, was to bring about this marriage. He had clung to the idea to the last, and had only given it up when it had been impossible not to do so. Foma had changed the aspect of the affair. I need hardly say that, in spite of his delight, the old man saw through Foma. In short, it was clear that Foma Fomitch would be supreme in that household forever, and that there would be no limit to his despotism. We all know that even the most unpleasant and ill-humoured people are softened, if only for a time, when their desires are gratified. Foma Fomitch, on the contrary, seemed to grow stupider when he was successful, and held his nose higher in the air than ever. Just before dinner, having changed all his clothes, he settled down in an armchair, summoned my uncle, and, in the presence of the whole family, began giving him another lecture.
"Colonel," he began, "you are about to enter upon holy matrimony. Do you realize the obligation?"
And so on and so on. Imagine 10 pages of the size of the Journal des Débats, of the smallest print, filled with the wildest nonsense, in which there was absolutely nothing dealing with the duties of marriage, but only the most shameful eulogies of the intellect, mildness, magnanimity, manliness, and disinterestedness of himself, Foma Fomitch. Everyone was hungry. They all wanted their dinners, but in spite of that, no one dared to protest, and everyone heard the twaddle reverently to the end. Even Batsheyev, in spite of his ravenous appetite, sat without stirring, absolutely respectful. Gratified by his own eloquence, Foma Fomitch grew livelier, and even drank rather heavily at dinner, proposing the most extraordinary toasts. He proceeded to display his wit by being jocose, at the expense of the happy pair, of course. Everybody laughed and applauded, but some of the jokes were so gross and suggestive that even Batsheyev was embarrassed by them. At last Nastenka jumped up from the table and ran away, to the indescribable delight of Foma Fomitch, but he immediately pulled himself up. Briefly, but in strong terms, he dwelt upon Nastenka's virtues, and proposed a toast to the health of the absent one. My uncle, who a minute before had been embarrassed and unhappy, was ready to hug Foma Fomitch again. Altogether, the betrothed pair seemed somewhat ashamed of each other and their happiness, and I noticed that they had not said a word to each other from the time of the blessing. They even seemed to avoid looking at one another. When they got up from dinner, my uncle vanished, I don't know where. I strolled out onto the terrace to look for him. There I found Foma sitting in an easy chair, drinking coffee and holding forth, extremely exhilarated. Only Yezhevikin, Bacheyev and Mazinchikov were by him. I stopped to listen.
"Why?" asked Foma. "Am I ready at this moment to go through fire for my convictions? And why is it that none of you are capable of going through fire? Why is it? Why is it?"
"Well, but it's unnecessary, Foma Fomitch, to go through fire," Yezhevikin said banteringly. "Why, what's the sense of it? In the first place it would hurt, and in the second it would burn. What would be left?"
"What would be left? Noble ashes would be left. But how should you understand? How should you appreciate me? To you, no great men exist, but perhaps some Caesar or Alexander of Macedon. And what did your Caesars do? Whom did they make happy? What did your vaunted Alexander of Macedon do? He conquered the whole earth. But give me such a phalanx, and I could be a conqueror too, and so could you, and so could he. On the other hand, he killed the virtuous Clitus, but I have not killed the virtuous Clitus. A puppy, a scoundrel. He ought to have had a thrashing, and not to have been glorified in universal history, and Caesar with him."
"You might spare Caesar anyway, Foma Fomitch."
"I won't spare the fool," cried Foma.
"No, don't spare him."
Bacheyev, who had also been drinking, backed him up.
"There is no need to spare them. They are all flighty fellows. They care for nothing but pirouetting on one leg. Sausage-eaters. Here, one of them was wanting to found a scholarship just now, and what is a scholarship? The devil only knows what it means. I bet it's some new villainy. And here is another who, in honourable society, is staggering about and asking for rum. Well, I have no objection to drinking, but one should drink, and then take a rest, and afterwards maybe drink again. It's no good sparing them. They are all scoundrels. You are the only enlightened one among them, Foma."
If Bacheyev surrendered to anyone, he surrendered unconditionally and absolutely without criticism. I looked for my uncle in the garden, by the pond in the most secluded spot. He was with Nastenka. Seeing me, Nastenka shot into the bushes as though she were in fault. My uncle came to meet me with a beaming face. There were tears of happiness in his eyes. He took both my hands and warmly pressed them.
"My dear," he said, "I still cannot believe in my happiness. Nastya feels the same. We only marvel and glorify the Almighty. She was crying just now. Would you believe it? I hardly know what I am doing yet. I am still utterly beside myself and don't know whether to believe it or not. And why has this come to me? Why? What have I done? How have I deserved it?"
"If anyone deserves anything, it is you, uncle," I said with conviction. "I have never seen such an honest, such a fine, such a kind-hearted man as you."
"No, Seryozha, no, it is too much," he answered, as it were with regret. "What is bad is that we are kind. I am talking only about myself, really, when we are happy. But when we are unhappy, it is best not to come near us. Nastenka and I were only just talking of that. Though I was dazzled by Foma, up to this very day, perhaps, would you believe it, I did not quite believe in him, though I did assure you of his perfection. Even yesterday I did not believe in him when he refused such a present. To my shame, I say it. My heart shudders at the memory of this morning, but I could not control myself. When he spoke of Nastya, something seemed to stab me to the very heart. I did not understand, and behaved like a tiger.
"Well, uncle, perhaps that was only natural." My uncle waved away the idea.
"No, no, my boy, don't say so. The fact of it is, all this comes from the depravity of my nature, from my being a gloomy and sensual egoist, and abandoning myself to my passions without restraint. That's what Foma says."
What could one answer to that?
"You don't know, Seriosia," he went on with deep feeling, "how often I have been irritable, unfeeling, unjust, haughty, and not only to Foma. Now it has all come back to my mind, and I feel ashamed that I have done nothing hitherto to deserve such happiness. Nastya has just said the same thing, though I really don't know what sins she has, as she is an angel, not a human being. She has just been saying that we owe a terrible debt of gratitude to God, that we must try now to be better and always to be doing good deeds. And if only you had heard how fervently, how beautifully she said all that. Oh, my God, what a wonderful girl!"
He stopped in agitation. A minute later he went on.
"We resolved, my boy, to cherish Foma in particular, Mama, and Tatiana Ivanovna. Tatiana Ivanovna, what a generous-hearted creature! Oh, how much I have been to blame towards all of them! I have behaved badly to you, too. But if anyone should dare to insult Tatiana Ivanovna now, oh, then... Oh, well, never mind. We must do something for Mizinchikov, too."
"Yes, uncle. I have changed my opinion of Tatiana Ivanovna now. One cannot help respecting her and feeling for her."
"Just so, just so," my uncle assented warmly. "One can't help respecting her. Now, Korovkin, for instance, no doubt you laugh at him,"
he added, glancing at me timidly.
"And we all laughed at him this afternoon. And yet, you know, that was perhaps unpardonable. You know, he may be an excellent, good-hearted man, but fate... he has had misfortunes. You don't believe it, but perhaps it really is so."
"No, uncle, why shouldn't I believe it?" And I began fervently declaring that even in the creature who has fallen lowest, there may still survive the finest human feelings, that the depths of the human soul are unfathomable, that we must not despise the fallen, but, on the contrary, ought to seek them out and raise them up, that the commonly accepted standards of goodness and morality were not infallible, and so on and so on. In fact, I warmed up to the subject, and even began talking about the realist school. In conclusion, I even repeated the verses, "When from dark errors subjugation," etc. My uncle was extraordinarily delighted.
My dear," he said, much touched, "you understand me fully, and have said much better than I could what I wanted to express. Yes, yes. Oh, good heavens, why is it man is wicked? Why is it that I am so often wicked when it is so splendid, so fine to be good? Nastya was saying the same thing just now. Oh, but look, though, what a glorious place this is,"
he added, looking round him.
"What scenery! What a picture! What a tree! Look, you could hardly get your arms round it. Oh, what sap! What foliage! What sunshine! Oh, how gay everything is, washed clean after the storm! One would think that even the trees understand something, have feeling and enjoyment of life. Is that out of the question, eh? What do you think?"
"It's very likely they do, uncle. In their own way, of course."
"Oh, yes, in their own way, of course. Marvellous, marvellous is the Creator. You must remember all this garden very well, Seriosia. How you used to race about and play in it when you were little. I remember, you know, when you were little,"
he added, looking at me with an indescribable expression of love and happiness.
"You are not allowed to go to the pond alone. But do you remember, one evening, dear Katia called you to her and began fondling you? You had been running in the garden just before and were flushed. Your hair was so fair and curly. She kept playing with it and said, 'It is a good thing that you have taken the little orphan to live with us.' Do you remember?"
"Faintly, uncle."
"It was evening, and you were both bathed in the glow of sunset. I was sitting in a corner smoking a pipe and watching you. I drive into the town every month to her grave," he added, dropping his voice, which quivered with suppressed tears. "I was just speaking to Nastia about it. She said we would go together."
My uncle paused, trying to control his emotion. At that instant, Vido Pliasov came up to us.
"Vido Pliasov," said my uncle, starting, "have you come from Foma Fomich?"
"No, I have come more on my own affairs."
"Oh, well, that's capital. Now we shall hear about Korovkin. I wanted to inquire. I told him to look after him. Korovkin, I mean. What's the matter, Vido Pliasov?"
"I make bold to remind you," said Vido Pliasov, "that yesterday you were graciously pleased to refer to my petition and to promise me your noble protection from the daily insults I receive."
"Oh, surely you are not harping on your surname again?" cried my uncle in alarm.
"What can I do? Hourly insults."
"Oh, Vido Pliasov, Vido Pliasov, what am I to do with you?" said my uncle in distress. "Why, what insults can you have to put up with? You will simply go out of your mind. You will end your days in a madhouse."
"I believe I am in my right mind," Vido Pliasov was beginning.
"Oh, of course, of course," my uncle interposed. "I did not say that to offend you, my boy, but for your good. Why, what sort of insults do you complain of? I am ready to bet that it is only some nonsense."
"They won't let me pass."
"Who interferes with you?"
"They all do, and chiefly owing to Matryona. My life is a misery through her. It is well known that all discriminating people who have seen me from my childhood up have said that I am exactly like a foreigner, especially in the features of the face. Well, sir, now they won't let me pass on account of it. As soon as I go by, they all shout all sorts of bad words after me. Even the little children, who ought to be whipped, shout after me. As I came along here now, they shouted, 'I can't stand it. Defend me, sir, with your protection.'"
"Oh, Vido Pliasov, well, what did they shout? No doubt it was some foolishness that you ought not to notice."
"It would not be proper to repeat."
"Why, what was it?"
"It's a disgusting thing to say."
"Well, say it."
"Grishka the dandy has eaten the candy."
"Oh, what a man! I thought it was something serious. You should spit and pass by."
"I did spit. They shouted all the more."
"But listen, uncle," I said. "You see, he complains that he can't get on in this house. Send him to Moscow for a time, to that calligrapher. You told me that he was trained by a calligrapher."
"Well, my dear, that man, too, came to a tragic end."
"Why? What happened to him?"
"He had the misfortune," Vido Pliasov replied, "to appropriate the property of another, for which, in spite of his talent, he was put in prison, where he is ruined irrevocably."
"Very well, Vido Pliasov, calm yourself now, and I will go into it all and set it right," said my uncle. "I promise. Well, what news of Korovkin? Is he asleep?"
"No, sir, his honour has just gone away. I came to tell you."
"What? Gone away? What do you mean? How could you let him go?"
cried my uncle.
"Through the kindness of my heart, sir, it was pitiful to see him, sir. When he came to himself and remembered all the proceedings, he struck himself on the forehead and shouted at the top of his voice."
"At the top of his voice?"
"It would be more respectful to express it. He gave utterance to many varied lamentations. He cried out, how could he present himself now to the fair sex? And then he added, I am unworthy to be a man. And he kept talking so pitifully in choice language."
"A man of refined feeling. I told you, Sergei. But how could you let him go, Vido Pliasov, when I told you particularly to look after him? Oh, dear. Oh, dear."
"It was through the pity of my heart. He begged me not to tell you. His cabman fed the horses and harnessed them. And for the sum lent him 3 days ago, he begged me to thank you most respectfully and say that he would send the money by one of the first posts."
"What money is that, uncle?"
"He mentioned 25 silver roubles," answered Vido Pliasov.
"I lent it him at the station, my dear. He hadn't enough with him. Of course, he will send it by the first post. Oh, dear, how sorry I am. Shouldn't we send someone to overtake him, Seryozha?"
"No, uncle, better not send."
"I think so, too. You see, Seryozha, I am not a philosopher, of course, but I believe there is much more good in every man than appears on the surface. Korovkin, now, he couldn't face the shame of it. But let us go to Foma. We have lingered here a long time. He may be wounded by our ingratitude and neglect. Let us go. Oh, Korovkin! Oh, Korovkin!"
My story is ended. The lovers were united, and their good genius in the form of Foma Fomitch held undisputed sway. I might at this point make very many befitting observations, but in reality all such observations now are completely superfluous, such anyway is my opinion. I will instead say a few words about the subsequent fortunes of all the heroes of my tale. As is well known, no story is finished without this, and indeed it is prescribed by the rules. The wedding of the couple who had been so graciously made happy took place 6 weeks after the events I have described. It was a quiet family affair, without much display or superfluous guests. I was Nastenka's best man, Mizinchikov was my uncle's. There were some visitors, however. But the foremost, the leading figure, was of course Foma Fomitch. He was made much of. He was carried on their shoulders. But it somehow happened that, on this one occasion, he was overcome by champagne. A scene followed, with all the accompaniment of reproaches, lamentations, and outcries. Foma ran off to his room, locked himself in, cried that he was held in contempt, that now new people had come into the family, and that he was therefore nothing, not more than a bit of rubbish that must be thrown away. My uncle was in despair. Nastenka wept. Madame la Générale, as usual, had an attack of hysterics. The wedding festival was like a funeral. And 7 years of living like that with their benefactor, Foma Fomitch, fell to the lot of my poor uncle and poor Nastenka. Up to the time of his death, Foma Fomitch died a year ago, he was sulky, gave himself airs, was ill-humoured and quarrelsome. But the reverence for him of the couple he had made happy, far from diminishing, actually increased every day with his caprices. Yegor Ilyich and Nastenka were so happy with each other that they were actually afraid of their happiness, and thought that God had given them too much, that they were not worthy of such blessings, and were inclined to expect that their latter days would be spent in hardship and suffering to atone for them. it will be readily understood that in this meek household Fomar Fomitch could do anything that took his fancy. And what did he not do in those 7 years? One could never imagine to what unbridled absurdities his pampered, idle soul led him in inventing the most perverse, morally sybaritic caprices. My grandmother died 3 years after my uncle's marriage. Fomar was stricken with despair at his bereavement. His condition at the time is described with horror in my uncle's household to this day. When they were throwing earth into the grave, he leapt into it, shouting that he would be buried in it too. For a whole month they would not give him a knife or fork, and on one occasion four of them forced open his mouth and took out of it a pin which he was trying to swallow. An outsider who witnessed the conflict observed that Fomar Fomitch might have swallowed the pin 1,000 times over during the struggle, but did not, however, do so. But everyone heard this criticism with positive indignation, and at once charged the critic with hard-heartedness and bad manners. Only Nastenka held her peace and gave a faint smile, while my uncle looked at her with some uneasiness. It must be observed that, though Fomar gave himself airs, and indulged his whims in my uncle's house as before, yet the insolent and despotic presumption with which he used to rail at my uncle was now a thing of the past. Fomar complained, wept, blamed, reproached, cried shame, but did not scold as he had done. There was never another scene like the one concerned with Your Excellency, and this, I think, was due to Nastenka. Almost imperceptibly, she compelled Fomar to yield some points and to recognise some limits. She would not see her husband humiliated, and insisted on her wishes being respected. Fomar perceived clearly that she almost understood him. I say almost, for Nastenka, too, humoured Fomar, and even seconded her husband whenever he sang the praises of his mentor. She tried to make other people, too, respect everything in her husband, and so publicly justified his devotion to Fomar Fomitch. But I'm sure that Nastenka's pure heart had forgiven all the insults of the past. She forgave Fomar everything when he brought about her marriage. And what is more, I believe she seriously, with all her heart, entered into my uncle's idea that too much must not be expected from a victim who had once been a buffoon, but, on the contrary, balm must be poured on his wounded heart. Poor Nastenka had herself been one of the humiliated. She had suffered, and she remembered it. A month after the death of his old patroness, Fomar became quieter, even mild and friendly. But on the other hand, he began to have quite sudden attacks of a different sort. He would fall into a sort of magnetic trance, which alarmed everyone extremely. Suddenly, for instance, the sufferer, while saying something or even laughing, would in one instant become unconscious and rigid, and rigid in the very position he happened to be in a moment before the attack. If, for instance, he was laughing, he would remain with a smile on his lips. If he were holding something, a fork, for instance, the fork would remain in his raised hand. Later on, of course, the hand would drop, but Fomar Fomitch felt nothing and knew nothing of its dropping. He would sit, stare, even blink, but would say nothing, hear nothing, and understand nothing. This would last sometimes for a whole hour. Of course, everyone in the house nearly died of fright, held their breath, walked about on tiptoe, and shed tears. At last, Fomar would wake up, feeling terribly exhausted, and would declare that he had seen and heard absolutely nothing all that time. The man must have been so perverse, so eager to show off, that he endured whole hours of voluntary agony solely in order to say afterwards, "Look at me.
I even feel more intensely than you." Finally, Foma cursed my uncle for the hourly slights and insults he received from him, and went to stay with Mr. Batcheyev. The latter, who had quarrelled with Foma Fomitch many times since my uncle's marriage, but always ended by begging his pardon, on this occasion took the matter up with extraordinary warmth. He welcomed Foma with enthusiasm, stuffed him with good things, and at once resolved on a formal breach with my uncle, and even on lodging a complaint against him. There was a bit of land in dispute between them, though they never disputed about it, for my uncle had yielded all claim to it, and had freely given it to Mr. Batcheyev. Without saying a word to anyone, Mr. Batcheyev ordered out his carriage, drove off to the town, there scribbled off a petition, and handed it in, appealing to the court to adjudge him the land formally, with compensation for loss and damage, and so to punish contumacy and robbery. Meanwhile, next day Foma Fomitch, getting bored at Mr. Batcheyev's, forgave my uncle, who came to apologize, and went back to Stepanchikovo. The wrath of Mr. Batcheyev, when he returned from the town and did not find Foma, was terrible. But 3 days later he turned up at Stepanchikovo to apologize, begged my uncle's pardon with tears in his eyes, and quashed his petition. My uncle made the peace between him and Foma Fomitch the same day, and Batcheyev followed Foma Fomitch about like a little dog, and again said at every word,
"You are a clever fellow, Foma. You are a learned man, Foma."
Foma Fomitch is now lying in his grave near his old patroness. Over him stands an expensive monument of white marble covered with lamentations and eulogistic inscriptions. Yegor Ilyich and Nastenka sometimes go for a walk to the cemetery to pay reverent homage to his memory. They cannot even now speak of him without great feeling. They recall all his sayings, what he ate, what he liked. His things have been preserved as priceless treasures. Feeling so bereaved, my uncle and Nastya grew even more attached to each other. God has not granted them children. They grieve over this, but dare not repine. Sashenka has long been married to an excellent young man. Ilyusha is studying in Moscow. And so my uncle and Nastya are alone together, and are devoted to each other. Their anxiety over each other is almost morbid. Nastya prays unceasingly. If one of them dies first, I think the other will not survive a week. But God grant them long life. They receive everyone with a most cordial welcome, and are ready to share all they have with anyone who is unfortunate. Nastenka is fond of reading the lives of the saints, and says with compunction that to do ordinary good work is not enough, that one ought to give everything to the poor and be happy in poverty. But for his concern for Ilyusha and Sashenka, my uncle would have done this long ago, for he always agrees with his wife in everything. Praskovya Ilyinichna lives with them, and enjoys looking after their comfort. She superintends the management of the place. Mr. Batcheyev made her an offer of marriage very soon after my uncle's wedding, but she refused him point blank. It was concluded from that she would go into a nunnery, but that did not come off either. There is one striking peculiarity about Praskovya Ilyinichna's character: the craving to obliterate herself completely for the sake of those she loves, to efface herself continually for them, to watch for their every inclination, to humour all their caprices, to wait upon them and serve them. Now, on the death of her mother, she considers it her duty not to leave her brother, and to take care of Nastenka in every way. Old Yezhevikin is still living, and has taken to visiting his daughter more and more frequently of late. At first he drove my uncle to despair by absenting himself from Stepanchikovo almost entirely, and also keeping away his small fry, as he called his children. All my uncle's invitations were in vain. He was not so much proud as sensitive and touchy. His oversensitive amour-propre sometimes approached morbidity. The idea that he, a poor man, should be entertained in a wealthy house from kindness, that he might be regarded as an intrusive and unwelcome guest, was too much for him. He sometimes even declined Nastenka's help, and only accepted what was absolutely essential. From my uncle he would take absolutely nothing. Nastenka was quite mistaken when she told me that time in the garden that her father played the fool for her sake. It was true that he was extremely eager at that time to marry Nastenka to Yegor Ilyich, but he acted as he did simply through an inner craving to give vent to his accumulated malice. The impulse to jeer and mock was in his blood. He posed as the most abject, grovelling flatterer, but at the same time made it perfectly clear that he was only doing this for show. And the more cringing his flattery, the more malignantly and openly apparent was the mockery behind it. It was his way. All his children were successfully placed in the best scholastic establishments in Moscow and Petersburg. But this was only after Nastenka had made it perfectly clear to him that it was being paid for out of her own pocket, that is, out of the 30,000 given her by Tatiana Ivanovna. That 30,000 she had actually never taken from Tatiana Ivanovna. But not to grieve and mortify her, they appeased her by promising to appeal to her at any sudden emergency. What they did was this. To satisfy her, considerable sums were borrowed from her on two occasions. But Tatiana Ivanovna died 3 years ago, and Nastya received her 30,000 all the same. The death of poor Tatiana Ivanovna was sudden. The whole family were getting ready for a ball given by a neighbour, and she had hardly decked herself out in her ball dress and put on a fascinating wreath of white roses when she suddenly felt giddy, sat down in an easy chair, and died. They buried her in the wreath. Nastya was in despair. Tatiana Ivanovna had been cherished and looked after like a little child in the house. She astonished everyone by the good sense of her will. Apart from Nastenka's 30,000, her whole fortune of 300,000 was devoted to the education of poor orphan girls, and the provision of a sum of money for each on leaving the institution. In the year that she died, Miss Perepelitsin was married. On the death of Madame la Générale, she had remained in the family in the hope of ingratiating herself with Tatiana Ivanovna. Meanwhile, the petty official who had bought Mishino, the little village in which our scene with Obnoskin and his mother over Tatiana Ivanovna took place, was left a widower. This individual was terribly fond of going to law, and had six children. Supposing that Miss Perepelitsin had money, he began making proposals to her through a third person, and she promptly accepted them. But Miss Perepelitsin was as poor as a hen. Her whole fortune was 300 silver rubles, and that was given her by Nastenka on her wedding day. Now the husband and wife are quarrelling from morning till night. She pulls his children's hair and boxes their ears. As for him, she scratches his face, so people say, and is constantly throwing her superior station as a major's daughter in his face. Mizinchikov has also established himself. He very sensibly gave up all his hopes of Tatiana Ivanovna, and began little by little to learn farming. My uncle recommended him to a wealthy count, who had an estate of 3,000 serfs, 60 miles from Stepanchikovo, and who occasionally visited his property. Observing Mizinchikov's abilities, and influenced by my uncle's recommendation of him, the Count offered him the post of steward on his estate, dismissed his former German steward, who, in spite of the vaunted German honesty, stripped his master like a lime tree. 5 years later, the estate was unrecognizable. The peasants were prosperous. The farming was developed in ways previously impossible. The returns were almost doubled. In fact, the new steward distinguished himself, and was talked of for his abilities as a farmer all over the province. Great was the amazement and chagrin of the Count when, at the end of the 5 years, Mizintchikov insisted on giving up his situation in spite of all protests and offers of increased salary. The Count imagined that he had been lured away by a rival landowner in his own neighbourhood or in another province. And everyone was astonished when, 2 months after giving up his post, Mizintchikov acquired an excellent estate of 100 serfs, about 30 miles from the Count's, purchased from a hussar, a friend of his who had squandered all his fortune. The 100 serfs he promptly mortgaged, and a year later he had acquired another property of 60 serfs in the neighbourhood. Now he is a landowner, and the management of his estate is unequalled. Everyone wonders how he came by the money all at once. Some people shake their heads. But Mizintchikov is perfectly self-possessed and feels that he is absolutely right. He has sent for his sister from Moscow, the sister who gave him her last 3 rubles to buy boots when he was setting off for Stepanchikovo, a very sweet girl, no longer in her first youth, gentle and loving, well-educated, but extremely timid. She had been all the time dragging out a miserable existence in Moscow as a companion to some charitable lady. Now she worships her brother and keeps house for him. She regards his will as law and thinks herself happy. Her brother does not spoil her. He makes her work rather hard, but she does not notice it. She has become a great favourite at Stepanchikovo, and I am told that Mr. Bacheyev is not indifferent to her. He would make her an offer, but is afraid of being refused. We hope, however, to give a fuller account of Mr. Bacheyev's doings in another story. Well, I think I have dealt with all the characters of Stepanchikovo. Oh, I had forgotten. Gavrila has greatly aged and completely forgotten his French. Falalei has made a very decent coachman, while poor Vido Pliasov was for many years in a madhouse, and I believe died there. In a few days I am going to Stepanchikovo, and will certainly inquire about him from my uncle.